From PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. The University of Papua New Guinea is refusing to let seven students who were granted a stay order against the administration's decision to terminate them register for classes. This is in relation to their roles in student protests against the Prime Minister Peter O'Neill earlier in the year, which saw the academic year suspended for months on end. The national newspaper reported an interim court order granted Justice Leka Nubu on Friday last week prohibited the university, its servants and agents from preventing the students from attending classes. But one of the student leaders involved in the court action, Hercules Jim, told Karori Hawkins they have been trying to register for classes since Friday, but they have been prevented from doing so by security personnel and staff at the university.
The order also says that the administration and the agents are not allowed to stop the students from attending classes. But we were not allowed to register last week Friday. We had made several attempts to move into the campus over a weekend that was also declined by the university security force. We made several attempts to register on Monday, but was rejected by the administration, especially the registrar, Jennifer Poppet. We made several attempts also this morning to attend classes and register, but we were told to fill up the form, registration form this morning, but not to attend classes. What they are saying is that the court has order, has made order, but the administration process will take its own course. But from what we understand, we were supposed to be registered last week Friday, and we are supposed to be in the classes, attending classes starting today. And for whatever reason, we are not having classes, and yes, we are still waiting for the administration.
So they're basically in defiance of a court order, or are they saying that despite the court order, they will wait for the 20th of October before making a decision on your case?
Basically, they are defying the court order. We were supposed to be registered last Friday, and to date now, we are not registered and we are not attending classes.
So the in the national report, it's saying seven of you are named student leaders and representatives. But how does this affect other students? Are you also fighting for the rights of other students?
Yes. Our case, whether we win or lose, will determine the other students. But for now, seven of us have taken the matter to the court, while the next, the other 18 are still waiting for the administration decision and the termination.
So it's still quite a tentative and sensitive situation, it seems, for you.
It is. We don't know why they're not following the national court order.
Yes, and the 20th of October is a long way away. What are you going to do about it if the university continues to not accommodate you?
Yes, administration has filed an affidavit to our lawyer, and they're trying to remove our temporary stay order.
So the stay order is what they're trying to remove?
Yes, they're trying to remove our stay order for whatever reason, we're not sure, but the hearing will be tomorrow morning.
Leaders from six Pacific Island nations have highlighted concern about West Papua while speaking at the United Nations General Assembly. At the general debate of the Assembly's 71st session, Vanuatu, Solomon Islands, Tonga, Nauru, Marshall Islands, and Tuvalu called for UN action on alleged human rights abuses in Papua. Calls for West Papuan self-determination rights to be respected were also made by some of the leaders. Johnny Blades filed this report.
Human rights abuses in Papua region were linked by the Solomon Islands Prime Minister to the pursuit of self-determination by indigenous West Papuans. Manasa Sogovare said there was a case to challenge the legality of the controversial UN-sanctioned process by which Papua was incorporated into Indonesia.
Human rights violations in West Papua and the pursuit for self-determination of West Papua are two sides of the same coin. Many reports on human rights violations in West Papua emphasize the inherent corroboration between the right to self-determination that results in direct violation of human rights by Indonesia and its attempts to smother any form of opposition.
In a call echoed by the other Pacific leaders, the Marshall Islands President Hilda Heine pushed for the situation to be independently probed.
Given the importance of human rights to my country, I request that the UN Human Rights Council initiate a credible and independent investigation of alleged human rights violations in West Papua.
Jakarta's response came from an official at Indonesia's permanent mission to the UN. Nara Masista Rakhmatia said her government categorically rejected accusations of rights abuses in Papua, accusing the government's concerned of interfering in Indonesia's sovereignty. She singled out Vanuatu and Solomon Islands, suggesting other countries with human rights problems shouldn't point the finger at Indonesia.
These countries are using the General Assembly to advance their domestic agenda, and for some countries to divert attention from political and social problems at home. The said countries are also using false and fabricated information as the basis of their statement. The conducts of these countries undermine the UN Charter and are detrimental to the credibility of this assembly.
The official reiterated Jakarta's stand that it has mechanisms in place to deal with human rights abuses in Papua. Yet the Prime Minister of Tuvalu, Enele Sopoanga, said that the UN must not ignore what's happening to Papua's indigenous Melanesians.
It must not allow actions in the guise of principles of non-interference and sovereignty as reasons for inaction. The UN must act on this issue and find a workable solution to give autonomy to the indigenous peoples of West Papua.
Nara Masista Rakhmatia said the Pacific leaders' statements on Papua were politically motivated and designed to assist separatist groups which have violently attacked civilians. However, it's understood to be the first time so many governments have raised concern about West Papua at a UN General Assembly debate. This is Johnny Blades.
A Tongan noble representative has told the Commonwealth Secretariat meeting that countries need to prepare for the possibility of climate change-induced migration. Lord Fatutea was part of a panel that led discussions at a meeting which was held on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York. Lord Fatutea told Koro Vatuata he wanted to share about the needs of the Pacific.
The main message was twofold. Number one, because we bear the major brunt of climate change, although we bear practically no responsibility for the emissions. We have to engage with international bodies and with the metropolitan foreign governments to work towards implementation and enforcement ratification as soon as possible of things like the Paris Agreement, so that the causes of climate change and therefore climate change induced migration are brought down, as well as ensuring that on our end we have as much adaptation as possible, so that we're able to institute preventative measures so that we're ready for whatever the effects of climate change may be within a comprehensive policy of giving our citizens as many options as possible.
You have a legal background. I understand that there is a need for, I guess, some sort of legal framework when it comes to climate change-induced migration, isn't there? This has to be done properly.
Most definitely. And that's something which I mentioned in my address and which the Baroness Scotland, new Secretary General, also mentioned in her closing remarks. In my address, I alluded to the fact that because there are no concrete, definitive legal definitions of climate change-induced migrants or climate refugees, it's an area where jurisprudence, as Baroness Scotland mentioned, needs to be developed, because there are a spectrum of wide-ranging ramifications that may or may not be obvious at first look. For instance, in Tonga, where I'm from, the electorate that I represent in the House and where my states are the furthest north. It's a newer group of islands, particularly for myself, newer for all. So being the northernmost, it's often vulnerable to the effects of climate change, cyclones, et cetera, et cetera. But as an example, if there were a natural disaster or the effects of climate change and the population of the islands where I'm from were forced to migrate, it would not only have an effect on the people who had to migrate, but legal ramifications of Tonga no longer having a populace on that island or in that area would mean that questions would be raised about our claim to that particular island and the borders of our EEZ or economic zone because of that migration. So, for instance, claims may be raised from other Pacific islands that they can lay claim to those islands and therefore encroach on our EEZ. And it's these kinds of legal issues that at first look may not be obvious, but they're most definitely raised by climate change-induced migration. It's something for us to be prepared for and to address.
Fijian exporters say they are looking forward to see the promises of better biosecurity arrangements with Australia as new entrepreneurs enter the export market. At a recent business event in Fiji, Australian authorities were quizzed over long-term delays in clearing containers at Australian ports. A new container cleaning deal with Fiji could lead to more efficient clearance terms, something exporters say is well overdue. Alex Peralte reports.
The new sea container hygiene system will allow for containers to be cleaned in Fiji before leaving. Fijian exporters say for many years the excuse for long delays in Australia was a concern over the giant African snail that Fiji doesn't have. A spokesperson for Australia's Department of Agriculture and Water Resources says it's not a problem with the snail, but an issue over soil contamination. Michael Towler exports flotation devices and says container hygiene is very different from biosecurity risks such as pests, and Fiji should be treated fairly.
This story has changed dramatically. They were simply saying to us, we acknowledge that Fiji doesn't have a giant African snail problem, it's a container hygiene issue. And I keep saying, well, treat it as one instead of a biological problem.
Michael Towler says the problem has been around for more than a decade and has hurt his business and others. He says his exports to China are cleared more quickly than those to Australia.
Our products are taking longer to get to our customers from a port that's much closer to Australia. But secondly, until the actual product is delivered to the customers, we don't get paid. So it's actually having an impact on our cash flow.
In April, the Fiji Biosecurity Authority intercepted 28 adult giant African snails and 500 eggs, the largest effort in the history of quarantine operations in the country. They say it's proof that Fiji's standards are high and officials are vigilant. But Australia's biosecurity officials say they too need to be vigilant, and there are pests that can hitchhike on ships, as well as dangerous seeds and microbes that can harm soil. That's why Fiji remains on what Australia calls its country action list. New entrepreneurs in Fiji say they work hard with Fiji Biosecurity to ensure products meet those high standards, and some have had surprising success. Jody Smith is the award-winning operator of the Renandi Plantation, which exports organic ginger. She says a lot of her success is due to her hard-working staff.
They've undergone rigorous training, so training is one of the most important things that we do at Renandi Plantation. We also have a lot of support from biosecurity, from pharma, and they have helped us basically set the standards, and then our training has helped us implement them.
Ms. Smith has now formed her own company, Cocoterra, and is exporting 100% coconut products. At the recent Business Council meeting in Fiji, Australia's Pacific Minister Concetta Ferravanti-Wells said Australian businesses were excited at being a part of Fiji's infrastructure boom, but said the benefit should be felt by Fijian businesses as well.
It should also help Fiji's businesses secure competitive contracts and reliable and competitive priced supplies.
Fiji's Trade Minister Fayaz Koya says he's committed to helping local entrepreneurs like Ms. Smith and will continue to work with Australia on biosecurity issues. This is Alex Perrottet.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. A Pacific academic says the proposed regional trade deal, Pacer Plus, has a deeper significance in today's geopolitical climate in securing Western influence in the Pacific. This is according to Pala Malosa, who is a Ni Vanuatu lecturer at the Victoria University of Wellington School of Accountancy and Commercial Law. His comments are in light of questions around why Australia and New Zealand are strongly pushing for Pacer Plus to be signed this year, despite standing to gain less than the Pacific Island countries from the deal. Mr. Malosa says growing international interest in the Pacific has given rise to the need for Western powers to restate their predominance in the region. He spoke to Karori Hawkins.
You know, we always have to go beneath the words, the public policy words of these agreements. It does have to do with international trade. It does have to do with economics, but it's also highly political, and that control. The control of the region, especially with other powers, especially Southeast Asian powers like Indonesia, like China, like Taiwan in the region. That's the geopolitical context. So having New Zealand and Australia produce trade agreements that are favourable to them, that's not just good for New Zealand and Australia's own economies, but it's also good for that Western control of this particular part of the globe. And that's very important. I know we'll probably get to this later on, but, you know, when we talk about things like what does the Pacific have to trade with these bigger powers, keep in mind, number one, if you look at the Pacific as a whole, we do have some very, very rich resources to trade. I mean, just look at Papua New Guinea. Look at West Papua, which is not exactly trade. It's under colonial occupation at the moment. But in terms of mineral resources, including untapped ones, you know, all these great imperial powers around the world, they're facing energy crises. So everyone's maneuvering to try to find and to secure pockets, sources for energy, oil, fossil fuel, on top of all the all the resources that go towards maintaining an industrial economy, like gold, like copper, like tin, like some of these heavy metals that go into some of the more advanced technologies we use these days. And that's only the mineral stuff, the material stuff. Also in terms of cultural capital and human resources, again, our Pacific cultures are the richest cultures in terms of that within this region. You know, if you want to talk about art, history, all the intellectual resources that come out of our indigenous traditions, medicinal, in terms of the study of, you know, different sciences, we all have things to contribute towards that. So that's kind of the long answer to why Australia and New Zealand are really interested.
We also have one of the other bigger trade agreements or trade deals being negotiated is with the European Union, with the EPA. It's been going for quite a while now. Mm. Is that also a factor, you think, in Australia and New Zealand wanting PACER wrapped up?
Oh, yeah, no question, no question. I mean, it comes down to that first mover principle. If you can move first and secure trade deals, you establish legal precedents that are going to be hard to ignore if you're trying to negotiate other deals with other powers. Because if you establish arrangements that are different to what you established earlier, there's going to be certain conflicts and tensions arising from that. So you'll always have an advantage as first mover if you establish the trade deal first.
Looking at the concerns with it in the region, civil society NGOs have raised concerns about transparency, accountability, calling for a social impact study, an independent one. Mm. Are these concerns that are seen with other trade agreements, TPP maybe? Is that a normal thing to have there? And why is there so much secrecy, it seems, shrouded around these things?
It's certainly been a common feature of some of the more recent international trade agreements like the TPPA. And it's really concerning. I mean, if these political leaders actually cared about democracy, they wouldn't need secrecy. Release the documents to the public, gauge the sentiment of the people. That's how a functioning liberal democracy works. You know, my mum used to say, when you want to understand how people think and what they really believe, look at what they do. Don't look at what they say. Yeah, they're calling this thing a trade agreement, something that'll facilitate economic development. If you look at what they do, negotiating things behind closed doors, not releasing the documents to the public, not carrying out adequate consultation with key stakeholders, including Indigenous peoples, and including our peoples back in the islands, that speaks to a very, very deep lack of faith in the people and also a lack of respect of the people.
Finally, what does the future for the Pacific look like, a future with PACER Plus?
It looks like it'll be more of the same in the sense of Pacific Island countries' interests being subordinated to these bigger powers, Australia, New Zealand, and other global powers. The only an added concern, though, is this looks to be an intensification of this corporate power grab and resource grab. You know, all these functions, part of the free market model, help to open up the Pacific to Western outside exploitation in a way that doesn't really benefit our communities in the long term. And really, that's the future if deals like PACER Plus go through. Again, without adequate consultation or engagement with the people.
A quarter of Pacific students in New Zealand are missing out on crucial health care, and 15% can access dental care when it's needed. An Auckland University survey of nearly 15,000 students in 2015 was released this month, looking into their health and well-being. Community groups have been lending the charge to improve those statistics, but more needs to be done. Sally Murphy reports.
Lead author of the survey report, Jacinta Fa'alili-Fido, says her survey shows that health outcomes for Pacific youth can be improved.
In terms of access to health services and access to dental services, there was quite a difference there between Pacific and European, and so I think there's still a lot of work that could be done by our health sector in terms of making sure that our young people, when they want to access health services, are able to.
Ms. Fa'alili-Fido says despite Pacific youth living in challenging situations, there were positive trends in the survey. She says there have been major improvements in health and well-being, with Pacific youth increasingly aspiring to achieve an education and form stronger relationships with their family.
Pacific students drink less than our European students. So, you know, it's not always about a deficit there for Pacific. That in some, you know, a few areas, Pacific actually rated better. And in so many other areas, they were very similar.
Pacific Youth Leadership and Transformation Council leader Josiah Tuala-Mali'i says the survey results are not surprising and just reiterate the struggles they are facing.
I kind of hope that policymakers look at this and it's the fresh lens that they need to revisit the way that they deal with these issues. But for our community, it really just adds another set of papers to the stack. I really appreciate the work that they've done, but I guess the ball's in the court of decision makers now to see what they do with it.
Mr. Tuala-Mali'i says community groups are leading the way in educating the youth on what access they have to health and education.
But overall, there is just so much more to do, and that's not a real surprise. I know a lot of the programs and activities that the government and others try to run is just trying to wedge a solution into the system, but it's not changing the system. And so for me, this just reinforces that to close the parity gap that our community faces, we need systemic change.
The survey also found between 2001 and 2012, there was a 4% decrease in the proportion of Pacific students reporting significant depressive symptoms. Almost a quarter of students reported their parents worrying about not having enough food, and 36% said that someone at home sleeps in a room not designated for sleeping in. Korsali Murphy, Tene.
For the first time, a genetic disorder affecting part of Fiji's indigenous population has been documented on film. Fiji has one of the highest rates of people with albinism in the world, yet very little is known by the locals. The disorder affects pigmentation of the skin, hair, and eyes, resulting in very fair skin and white and light-colored hair. The recent release of the short film, Coming Out of the Shadows, is helping raise awareness of the disorder, which affects one in every 700 indigenous Fijians. Indira Stewart has the story.
Fiji is undoubtedly one of the most popular tourist destinations in the Pacific, a place many travel to just to enjoy the sun. But what many tourists don't realise is that a significant number of locals are trying to avoid it. The worldwide average of countries who have people with albinism is 1 in 17,000. In Fiji, the rate is 1 in 700. This young girl singing with her family is Sisi Ngalulu, one of four families in the film who share their experience about what life is like for them. Her parents, Edward and Lavinia, have four children, two of whom have albinism. Dr. Margot Whitfield is an Australian dermatologist who has been helping to raise awareness of albinism in Fiji.
It's not known why albinism is quite so high in Fiji. One of the possible theories are that if you live on an island community, for example, of 3,000, and even if your family chooses not to marry anyone in the immediate family, it's possible that five or six generations ago, you may in fact be marrying or partnering with somebody from the same original gene pool as yourself. So it's very easy for a hidden mistake to be able to reappear.
Until recently, the huge challenges people with albinism faced in Fiji remained largely hidden. Last year, Dr. Whitfield organised the first Fiji Albinism Awareness Symposium to raise awareness of the genetic disorder. Many families living with albinism attended the symposium alongside Director Christine Nestle, who said she had no idea how prevalent it was in Fiji until then.
You know, so many Australians go to Fiji for holidays, but when I mentioned it to friends here, you know, people that had been to Fiji, they were just amazed when I said, did you realise that in Fiji that they have one of the highest rates of albinism in the world? And they're like, really?
She created the documentary to raise awareness of albinism and to give a voice to some of the families.
So I thought it would be great just to make a short documentary so that people, you know, the families of people with albinism and people with albinism themselves, they could tell their own stories. That was the idea, so we could see it through their eyes.
The film highlights the difficulties of living with albinism in a country which knows very little about it.
Each time was the feeling of difference and suffering from that, because the children with albinism are going to school, they've got white skin, so therefore they're different, and, well, in some cases they get bullied, but generally they just feel very different, and it's very difficult for people in that situation.
My name is Sal Sierra. I'm 14 years of age. In high school, it's very hard blending in with other students, going with other students that are not like me, different color than me, and yeah. No, I don't catch the bus. Because every time when I go in the bus, as soon as I enter, people start looking at me. Makes me feel very sometimes sad and angry, but I'm used to it.
People with albinism also face challenges in vision and risks to skin damage. They experience reduced sharpness and increased sensitivity to light. Many of the students at Fiji's School for the Blind have albinism and hope to break the ongoing cycle of people with albinism in Fiji struggling in its education system.
When these people were at school when they were younger, is that they didn't do well at school because they couldn't see. You know, they couldn't see the blackboard. And then they were getting, because not getting a good education, they were ending up having work where they're, you know, like working outside in the field.
Long-term sun exposure greatly increases the risk of skin cancers like melanoma. Yet Ms. Nestle says families struggled with the cost of sunscreen for their children.
They can't afford sunscreen. I have to admit, I was sort of horrified when they said it. And then I later just went into a few pharmacies in Suva, and it was so expensive, sunscreen. It was more expensive than here in Australia.
Ms. Nestle says there is strong concern among families around how their children with albinism will have access to good health care and education. She hopes the film will help gather more support in Fiji for those with albinism. This is Indira Stewart.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you want to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, it's very easy to do. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. We'll see you in 7 days. But a quick reminder, you can listen to the 3-time daily edition of Focus Asia Pacific on shortwave from PCJ Radio International. Until next time, so long and take care.